good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 514 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show is something of a change, looking at the effects on the individual of being surrounded by fast-moving, high technology grabbing one's attention. Our first presentation is by Nicholas Carr, author of Is the Internet Making Us Stupid? And to set the stage for it, I'm going to read an essay by Stephen Talbot of netfuture.org. The essay is entitled Multitasking Ourselves to Death. The New York Times, July 23, 1998, ran a story about the travails of multitasking, which began with this personal sketch, quote, "It's hard for Michael Redd to say just when doing one thing at a time began so deeply dissatisfying. His ratings with customers certainly soared since he started responding to their email as soon as it chimes in, no matter if he's on the phone or eating lunch or poring over a spreadsheet on some other screen. But his fondness for multitasking is not limited to the workspace. Mr. Redd is happiest when his attention is most divided, like on a recent weekend afternoon when he watched a movie on television while talking to his sister and writing on his laptop. During commercial breaks, he flipped through his CD jukebox with a remote control, searching for a song whose name he'd forgotten. I need to be able to do many things at once all the time, Mr. Redd said. This may sound strange, but it makes me feel better." Unquote. And the article ended with this, quote, "For Jai Mani, an 11-year-old in Manhattan, the urge to multitask is like a craving for food. When he gets home from rollerblading camp, he wants to do three things. Instead of listening to music for 30 minutes, watching TV for 30 minutes, checking your email for 30 minutes, you can do them all at the same time," said Jai, who's been known to watch television and keep an eye on his computer game in the high-gloss reflection of the piano while having a lesson. "It's just easier that way." Unquote. We also hear about a database designer who insists he can scan internet groups subconsciously while he talks to friends on the phone. An academic opines that you can't expand time, so what you try to do is deepen time by doing more things in the same period. Meanwhile, the article's author, Amy Harmon, observes that, quote, "The tasks we find ourselves attending to, however briefly, are often determined by what pops up on our screen." Unquote. As expected, the idea also surfaces that young people raised on MTV may be better than the rest of us at filtering and processing huge amounts of information from different sources. In fact, a bank executive is quoted as saying, "We had better feed this insatiable capacity, or else we will stifle these go-getters." He considers their new capacities a real sea change. Finally, quote, "Many multitaskers describe a sense of well-being that comes from the variety of tasks they're performing and the control they feel they exercise over which one comes first." Unquote. Having used only multitasking computers since I first set my hands on a keyboard in 1980, I too know this particular satisfaction. It is only during the past few years that I have, with any seriousness, asked myself what sort of toll I pay for an interrupt-driven style of consciousness. I don't think I've yet gotten to the heart of the matter, but I am quite sure that the crucial issues are generally overlooked. If there is a single theme of net future, It is the need for us to maintain a wakeful relationship to technology. Assaults on our attention are decisively important because our consciously directed attention is the only point at which we are fully awake. Attending to something is what it means to be awake to it, and we can only attend, in this sense, to one thing at a time. It is true that we can do many things at once. We can talk, drive a car, breathe, and digest food all at the same time. But our waking attention is single and indivisible. We may be able to switch it rapidly from one thing to another, but at any given instant it is consumed by the thing alone. There are many ways you can verify this. One is to look at an ambiguous figure, such as a line drawing of a cube. You'll find that you cannot see both orientations of the cube at the same time, despite the fact that both are there waiting for you to attend to them. The person who watches television while talking on the phone is missing a good part of the program and a good part of the conversation. Everything may be taken in sensorially, but only one thing at a time is attended to. What is happening when you manage to do both things at once is that you listen for a moment to the conversation and then, redirecting your attention, you pull from memory the last few phrases you heard from the television. While you are attending to your memories, you are no longer listening to the conversation partner or the television. You may alternate in this way with more or less success, but never without sacrificing the creative potentials of profound and sustained attention. So why does all this matter? Because the point where we exercise our attention is the point where we can manifest our highest capacities. It is the only point where we can gain mastery over technology or anything else, and the only point at which we can deepen understanding. Moreover, if we are not masters of our own attention, we are tools of our surroundings and of our own subconscious. You can assess your powers of attention easily enough. Simply see how long you can hold your attention upon a single topic, say, a common physical object, exploring its form and function, its materials and manufacture, its history, and so on. You will not be unusual if, despite your most intense efforts, your mind wanders within the first 30 seconds, which means your mind is out of control. If you want a thorough lesson in humility, try the exercise for 10 minutes. Unless you're an extremely rare individual, you, like I, will be forced to admit that your sovereign wakefulness is discouragingly dim. In other words, not much of our mental governing activity is something we do, as opposed to something that happens to us. To shift your attention rapidly from one thing to another, as prompted by your environment, an insistent questioning tone in your caller's voice, or a bit of spectacular violence on the television screen, this is not the epitome of executive efficiency, despite claims to the contrary. It's more like an abandonment of yourself, and therefore also of the other person, in this case, the telephone caller. I am not saying that the many things we do, beside paying attention, are worthless. It's a good thing the pianist does not have to attend to the movement of his fingers while he's interpreting a sonata. But we need to recognize that the things we do not attend to gain a certain automatic character. They're redeemed as fully human only when they are caught up in a higher attention and made to serve it, as when the pianist's technique serves his current striving for expression. Remove that higher attention, and what is left, whether it's the movement of fingers on a piano keyboard or a computer keyboard, is probably not worth anyone's time. I realize that these issues are not likely to grip the public's imagination, but this, I guess, is very much as it should be. the important issues today must not grip us, because the vital thing is that we should rouse ourselves to grip them. This requires an initiative on our part, a self-mastery, and a strengthening of the powers of willful attention, so that we can wrestle with matters of our own choosing, despite the continual coercions coming from without. If, on the other hand, our attention becomes wholly entrained by the mechanisms we have set in motion around us, for example, by what pops up on the screen, then we will have disappeared into those mechanisms. This will be true despite our exhilarated feelings of being in control, as we shift our attention with executive authority from one interrupt to another, within an overall context we have become incapable of questioning. If you'd like to re-listen to that at your own pace, it's available for download at unwelcomeguests.net/514. That piece and hundreds of essays like it are available from netfuture.org, which does have a topic index. I discovered that website about 7 years ago, and it certainly helped me to use technology less and to use it in a more thoughtful way. Our next speaker, Nicholas Carr, is another voice who warns of the dangers of multitasking and encourages a mindful use of technology. Early in his presentation, he talks about the invention of the map and how it changed human consciousness. Living in Bangladesh, I've certainly come to appreciate that map reading is not a universal skill, as reading, in fact, is a minority skill in a lot of parts of this country. And I haven't reflected on this before, but I think the lack of multitasking and the lack of technology is one of the aspects which has attracted me to live in Bangladesh, because of the undivided and uninterrupted nature of life there as compared to the perpetual busyness of the developed world. Of course, it's changing fast, especially in the cities, but that's a story for another episode. So let's now hear Nicholas Carr giving a presentation from last month in Seattle Town Hall.
I should say, I was thinking right before I came on that the fact that you would come out here and sit and listen quietly probably contradicts my entire thesis, but still it contradicts it in a very good way, so we need more such contradictions. And of course, if you start tweeting and checking your email, then all bets are off. The subject of The Shallows, my book, is the way that the tools we use to think with, what I refer to as our intellectual technologies, influence the way that we think. And I believe that you can trace that influence all the way through the intellectual history of humankind. In the book, I go back and talk about, for instance, the map, which was one of the earliest intellectual technologies, and it's something that we're so used to by now that it's hard to even imagine that at one point maps didn't exist. Somebody actually had to invent the map. And before that happened, the only way that people had a sense of where they were and how to navigate the world was through their direct sensory impressions, through what they saw, through what they heard in some cases. The map changed that, and suddenly we could figure out where we were and where we were going through an abstraction of physical space. And I would argue that that didn't just change the way we navigate and the way we plotted our course or set boundaries. It actually introduced a more abstract way of thinking in general to our minds. And a similar thing happened many millennia later with the invention of the mechanical clock. Here too, we up until then, we had basically seen time or understood time as a flow, as a natural flow, a cyclical flow. Suddenly with the mechanical clock, this natural flow was broken up into precise little units, which could be measured, and categorized and all sorts of other things. And here too, I think the technology brought us a different way of thinking, or at least gave a new emphasis to a certain way of thinking. And what's interesting about all these intellectual technologies and what they end up doing, I think, particularly interesting, is that the ultimate effects on the mind, on the human brain, weren't necessarily foreseen by the people who invented those technologies or by the people who originally began to use them. People who invented a map just wanted a better way to get around. People who invented the mechanical clock simply wanted a better way to schedule their time and coordinate work and other efforts with other people. And I think this, too, is a theme in intellectual history, that we create these technologies that become very important in society, and we create them for very practical purposes, but they end up having a profound influence on how we think, and in particular, what modes of thinking we stress or don't stress. And the main focus of the book is on two much more recent intellectual technologies. The book itself, which has only been around for about 2,000 years and only has been around in its printed form for about 550 years, which seems like a long time, but when you think about it, it's a very, very brief period in human history. And then much more briefly than that, the recent introduction of the Internet, which for most of us really only came into use about 20 years ago with the creation of the World Wide Web. So it's those two technologies in particular, and how we've seen with the book and how we're now seeing with the Internet, the same kinds of profound changes that we saw with the map and with the clock, that I'd like to talk to you about tonight, and that forms really the heart of my book, The Shallows. Let me start with some mildly scatological words from Aristotle, like the blood of animals in their excrement. That was how Aristotle described the human brain. He couldn't believe that this grayish compound of earth and water, another one of his phrases, could have anything to do with thinking or with sensation. Instead, he believed that the brain basically acted as the body's refrigerator. It cooled the heat of the blood as the blood rose from what he called the fiery regions of the heart. It's easy now for us today to laugh at Aristotle's mistake, but I think it's also easy to understand how the great philosopher was led so far astray. Our brain, packed into the crate of the skull, gives us no direct signal of its existence. We feel our heart beat. We feel our lungs expand and contract. Sometimes we feel our stomach churn. But our brain remains imperceptible to us. The source of consciousness lies beyond the grasp of consciousness. The brain's strangely remote quality, the way that it feels like it's both part of us and apart from us, still influences our perceptions, I would argue, in very subtle ways. We have a sense that our brain exists kind of in a state of splendid isolation, that its fundamental makeup is impervious to the vagaries of our day-to-day lives. While we know that our brain is an exquisitely sensitive monitor of experience, we want to believe that it lies beyond the influence of experience. We want to believe that the impressions our brain records as sensations and stores as memories leave no physical imprint on its own physical structure. To believe otherwise would, we feel, call into question the very integrity of the self. That, anyway, is how I felt a couple of years ago when I began to notice a troubling change in the way I was thinking. I was losing control, I realized, of my ability to concentrate, to pay attention. I felt it most strongly whenever I'd sit down to read something. Ever since I was a young boy, I've always found it easy to immerse myself in a book or a long article. My mind would get caught up in the twists of the narrative or the turns of the argument, and I could spend hour after hour turning page after page. That's no longer the case I had come to realize. Now when I sit down with a book, my mind starts to drift after only a paragraph or two. I get fidgety, lose the thread, begin looking for something else to do. I feel like I'm constantly dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle. And it's not just reading, in fact. What I've noticed is that any sort of deep, sustained concentration has become a trial. Now, at first I figured that this must be just a symptom of middle-aged mind rot. And there's probably some of that going on. But the more closely I examined my behavior, the more I realized that my brain, my mind, wasn't just drifting. It seemed like it was hungry. It seemed like it craved more information, more stimuli, more stuff. It wanted to be distracted. I began to suspect what was really going on. For nearly two decades now, I've been spending a lot of time online, searching and surfing, and sometimes adding to the great databases of the Internet. The web has certainly been a godsend to me as a writer. Research that once required days in the stacks or the periodical rooms of libraries can now be done in minutes. A few Google searches, some quick clicks on hyperlinks, and I have the piece of data or the pithy quote that I was after. And even when I'm not working, I'm as likely as not to be foraging in the web's info thickets, reading and writing emails, scanning headlines and blog posts, checking Facebook updates, watching videos, or just tripping lightly from link to link to link. Once I was a scuba diver in the sea of words. Now I zip along the surface like a guy on a jet ski. And I'm guessing that at least some of you might be able to relate. But wait a second, I thought. Could it really be possible that my use of the Internet was altering the patterns of my thought, even when I wasn't online? Was my ability to concentrate really something that could be lost simply by staring into a computer screen? In search of answers to those questions, I began looking into recent scientific discoveries about the brain to see if I could find some clues about my own condition. And what I discovered confirmed my fears. For many centuries, we've had a mistaken impression of how our brains develop and work. The conventional wisdom has long been that all our neural connections are forged during childhood and then remain fixed throughout adulthood. You may have learned in school, as I did, that as soon as we reach our 20s, our brains are fully formed and basically unchangeable. We can, of course, store new memories or lose old ones, but the assumption was that we weren't able to grow any new neurons or synapses, and that we couldn't reconnect our existing neurons and synapses into new circuits. It turns out that that was all wrong. Our brains actually remain malleable, or plastic, as neuroscientists say, throughout our lives. Mark Hallett, a top neurologist at the National Institutes of Health, puts it this way. We have learned that neuroplasticity is not only possible, but that it is constantly in action. That is the way we adapt to changing conditions, the way we learn new facts, and the way we develop new skills. Any experience we have, particularly if it's repeated frequently, can literally change the way our neurons are connected, altering the pathways of our thought. Now, there are many reasons to be grateful that our mental hardware is able to so readily adapt to experience, that even old brains can be taught new tricks. It provides all of us with a mental flexibility and intellectual suppleness that allows us to adapt to new situations, learn new talents, and in general, expand our horizons. But there's also a dark side. As particular circuits in our brain strengthen through the repetition of a physical or mental activity, they begin to transform that activity into a habit. The paradox of neuroplasticity is that for all the mental flexibility it grants us, it can end up locking us into narrow ways of thinking or of behaving. Once we've wired new circuitry in our brain, we want to keep exercising it. That's the way the brain fine-tunes its operations. Routine activities get carried out ever more quickly and efficiently, while unused circuits are pruned away. Plastic does not mean elastic, in other words. Our neural loops don't snap back to their former state the way a rubber band does. They hold on to their changed state. And there's nothing that says that the new state has to be a desirable one. Bad habits can be ingrained in our brains, in our brain cells, as easily as good ones. When it comes to the quality of our thought, our neurons and our synapses are entirely indifferent. So we know now that our brains can change, even way down at the cellular and molecular level, in response to our experiences and in response to our behavior. And we know that the changes can be good or they can be not so good. And that brings me back to my own brain, and perhaps some of your brains, and the question of what our ever-increasing use and dependence on the Internet might be doing to them. One thing seems very clear from my research into the mechanisms of neuroplasticity, and that is, if knowing what we know today about the brain's adaptability, you were to set out to invent a tool that would rewire our mental circuits as quickly and thoroughly as possible, you would probably end up designing something that looks and works a lot like the Internet. It's not just that we tend to use the technology regularly, even obsessively. It's that the net delivers precisely the kind of sensory and cognitive stimuli, repetitive, intensive, interactive, even addictive, that have been shown to result in strong and rapid alterations in brain circuits and functions. With the exception of alphabets and number systems, I would argue, the net may well be the single most powerful mind-altering technology that's ever come into general use. Just think about it. During the course of a day, most of us with access to the web spend at least a couple of hours online, sometimes a whole lot more than that. And during that time, we tend to repeat the same or similar actions over and over again, usually at a very high rate of speed and often in response to cues delivered through a screen or through a speaker. Some of the actions are physical ones. We tap the keys on our keyboard. We drag our mouse and click its left and right buttons or spin its scroll wheel. We draw the tips of our fingers across our trackpad. We use our thumbs to punch out text on the real or simulated keypads of our cell phones. We rotate our iPhones and our iPads to shift between landscape and portrait modes while manipulating the icons on their touch-sensitive screens. As we go through these motions, our gadgets deliver a steady stream of responses to our ears, to our fingers, to our eyes. Beeps, buzzes, flickering images, colorful links. The net engages all of our senses, except so far at least those of smell and taste, and it engages them intensively and simultaneously. It also provides a high-speed system for delivering rewards, positive reinforcements in psychological terms, which further encourage the repetition of both physical and mental actions. When we click a link, we get something new to look at and evaluate. When we Google or Bing a keyword, we receive, in the blink of an eye, a list of interesting information. When we send a text or an instant message or an email, we often get a reply in a matter of seconds or minutes. When we use Facebook, we attract new friends or form closer bonds with old ones. When we send a tweet, we're rewarded with retweets. It's a very hard sentence to say with a straight face. The net's interactivity, of course, gives us powerful tools, new tools for finding information, for expressing ourselves, and for conversing and sharing our thoughts with others. It also turns us into lab rats, constantly pressing levers to get tiny pellets of social or intellectual nourishment. The net commands our attention, in fact, with far greater insistency than our television or radio or morning newspaper ever did. Watch your kids texting their friends, or watch college students looking over the roll of new messages and requests on their Facebook page, or business people scrolling through their email on their BlackBerries. Or just consider yourself as you enter keywords into Google's search box and begin following a trail of links. What you see is a mind consumed with a medium. The real world recedes as we process the flood of symbols and stimuli coming through our devices. Our use of the Internet involves many paradoxes, but the one that promises to have the greatest long-term influence over how we think is this one. The net seizes our attention only to scatter it. We focus intensively on the medium itself, on the ever-changing screen, but we're constantly distracted by the medium's rapid-fire delivery of competing messages, alerts, and other stimuli. Whenever and wherever we log on, the net presents us with an incredibly seductive blur. I recently interviewed one of the great pioneers of neuroplasticity research, the University of California professor Michael Merznick. He talked about the Internet's power to cause not just modest alterations, but what he calls, quote, massive changes in our mental makeup. While acknowledging that it's now hard to imagine living without the Internet or online tools like search engines, he stresses that their heavy use has neurological consequences. I don't think it's any mystery what those consequences are. By now, there's a large body of research in psychology and in neuroscience that shows that when we take in information in a distracted way, we learn less, comprehend less, and understand less than when we pay close attention. The fundamental characteristics of the web as an intellectual technology, the links, the multimedia, the interruptions, the multitasking, are fundamental strengths of the technology, but they all take a cognitive toll. The web trains us to skim, and to scan, and to surf, and to browse, but it gives us no opportunity or encouragement to engage in quieter, more attentive, more solitary forms of thought. Things like contemplation, reflection, introspection, deep reading. Now, there's nothing wrong with skimming and scanning. We've always skimmed newspapers more than we've read them, and we routinely run our eyes over books and magazines in order to get the gist of a piece of writing and decide whether it warrants more thorough reading. The ability to skim text is every bit as important as the ability to read deeply. What is different, though, and troubling, is that skimming is now becoming our dominant mode of reading and of thinking. Once a means to an end, a way to identify information for deeper study, scanning is becoming an end in itself, our preferred way of gathering and making sense of information of all sorts. What we're experiencing, in a metaphorical sense, is a reversal of the early trajectory of civilization. We're evolving from being cultivators of personal knowledge to being hunters and gatherers in the electronic data forest. The news isn't all bad. There are some compensations. Research also shows that certain cognitive skills are enhanced and strengthened, and sometimes substantially so, by our use of computers and the net. These tend to involve, though, lower level or more primitive kinds of mental functions, such as hand-eye coordination, reflex response, and the processing and tracking of visual cues. If you play a lot of video games, for instance, you'll probably boost the speed with which you can shift your focus among different images and different tasks. As we practice browsing, surfing, scanning, and multitasking, our plastic brains almost certainly are becoming more adept at those sorts of tasks. It would be a very serious mistake, though, to look narrowly at those kind of benefits that the net provides and conclude that the technology is making us more intelligent. Jordan Grafman, who heads the Cognitive Neuroscience Unit at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, explains that the constant shifting of our attention when we're online may make our brains more nimble when it comes to multitasking, but improving our ability to multitask actually hampers our ability to think deeply and creatively. Grafman poses this question: does optimizing for multitasking result in better functioning, that is, creativity, inventiveness, productiveness? The answer, he says, is no. The more you multitask, the less deliberative you become, the less able to think and reason out a problem. You become, he argues, more likely to rely on conventional ideas and solutions rather than challenging them with original lines of thought. David Meyer, a University of Michigan neuroscientist and one of the leading experts on multitasking, makes a similar point. As we gain more experience in rapidly shifting our attention, We may overcome some of the inefficiencies inherent in multitasking, he says, but, and I'm quoting here, you can train until you're blue in the face, and you'd never be as good as if you just focused on one thing at a time. What we're doing when we multitask, he says, is learning to be skillful at a superficial level. The Roman philosopher Seneca may have put it best 2,000 years ago, to be everywhere is to be nowhere. And these ill effects don't go away when we turn off our computers, as researchers from Stanford discovered last year. They gave a battery of cognitive tests to a group of heavy online multitaskers, as well as a group of relatively light multitaskers. They found that the heavy multitaskers were much more easily distracted, had significantly less control over their attention, and were in general much less able to distinguish important information from trivia. The heavy multitaskers, the researchers were surprised to find, weren't even any good at multitasking. And I think that shows us how neuroplasticity, the ability of our brain to adapt to what we do, continues to influence the way we think, even when we're not using that the particular tool or technology that spurred those changes. Because all of these tests in the Stanford research were done not when these people were online, but when they were offline in taking the tests in different ways. It's particularly revealing and I think particularly disturbing to compare the net's impact on thinking with that of an earlier information technology, the book. When books became popular after the invention of the printing press, around 1450, a remarkable change in human consciousness took place. It was every bit as profound as the one we're going through today, but it couldn't have been more different in its effects. To sit down and read a long book required an ability to concentrate intently over a long period of time, to lose oneself in the pages, as we say today. Developing such mental discipline wasn't easy. The natural state of the human brain, like that of the brains of most of our relatives in the animal kingdom, is one of distractedness. Our predisposition is to shift our gaze, and hence our attention, from one object to another, to be aware of as much of what's going on around us as possible. These kinds of fast-paced, reflective shifts in focus, what psychologists call a bottom-up form of attention, where what's coming at you determines what you focus on, were once, of course, crucial to our survival. They reduced the odds that a predator would take us by surprise or that we'd overlook a nearby source of food. For most of history, the normal path of human thought was anything but linear and attentive. To read a book, therefore, was to practice an unnatural process of thought, one that demanded sustained attention and unbroken attention to a single static object. It required readers to place themselves at what T.S. Eliot in Four Quartets called the still point of the turning world. When we read a book, we train our brains to ignore everything else going on around us, to resist the urge to let our focus skip from one sensory cue to another. We forge or strengthen the neural circuits necessary to counter our instinctive distractedness. The ability to focus on a single task relatively uninterrupted, one psychologist has noted, represents a strange anomaly in human history. Many people had, of course, cultivated a capacity for sustained attention long before the book or even the alphabet came along. The hunter, the craftsman, the monk, all had to train their brains to control and concentrate their attention. What was so remarkable about book reading was that the deep concentration was combined with the highly active and efficient deciphering of text and interpretation of meaning. The reading of a sequence of printed pages was valuable not just for the knowledge that the readers acquired from the author's words, but for the way those words set off intellectual vibrations within their own minds. In the quiet spaces opened up by the prolonged, undistracted reading of a book, people made their own associations, drew their own inferences and analogies, fostered their own ideas. They thought deeply as they read deeply. Reading a book was and is a meditative act, but it doesn't involve a clearing of the mind. It involves a filling or replenishing of the mind. Readers of the printed word disengage their attention from the outward flow of passing stimuli in order to engage it more deeply with an inward flow of words, ideas, and emotions. That is the essence of the mental, unique mental process of deep reading. And it was the technology of the book that made this strange anomaly in our psychological history possible, at least in a broad sense. The brain of the book reader was more than a literate brain. It was a literary brain. Our rich cultural heritage, in fact, is unthinkable without the intimate exchanges that take place between reader and writer within the crucible of a book. After Gutenberg's invention, the bounds of language expanded rapidly as writers, competing for the eyes of ever more sophisticated and demanding readers, strive to express ideas and emotions with superior clarity, elegance, and originality. The vocabulary of the English language, once limited to just a few thousand words, grew to well over a million words as books proliferated. As language expanded, consciousness deepened. And that deepening extended beyond the page itself. It's no exaggeration to say that the writing and reading of books enhanced and refined people's experience of life and of nature. The great book historian Elizabeth Eisenstein writes that the remarkable virtuosity displayed by new literary artists who managed to counterfeit taste, touch, smell, or sound in mere words required a heightened awareness and closer observation of sensory experience that was passed on in turn to the reader. Like painters and like composers, writers were able to alter perception in a way that enriched rather than stunted sensuous response to external stimuli, expanded rather than contracted sympathetic response to the varieties of human experience. The words in books didn't just strengthen people's ability to think abstractly, though they certainly did that. They also enriched people's experience of the physical world, the world outside the book. The mind of the deep reader, the attentive, contemplative, literary mind, is what we stand to lose as we abandon the printed page and embrace the screen as our all-purpose information delivery device. We're not just what we read, the developmental psychologist Marianne Wolfe once told me, we are how we read. And let's not kid ourselves. The change in our reading and thinking habits is happening very quickly. Today, the average American spends 8.5 hours a day staring into a screen, TV, computer, cell phone. That same American spends just 20 minutes reading books and other printed works. Young adults spend an average of just 7 minutes a day reading words in print, a number that continues to decline very rapidly. For the last 5 centuries, the literary mind has been at the center of art, science, and society. As supple as it is subtle, it's been the imaginative mind of the Renaissance, the rational mind of the Enlightenment, the inventive mind of the Industrial Revolution, even the subversive mind of modernism. It may, very soon now, be yesterday's mind. I know we're not going to retreat from technology, nor would we want to. And I'm not suggesting that we engage in sentimental nostalgia for a bookish past. What I am suggesting is that we not rush blindly to discard old ways of reading, research, and thinking without giving deep consideration to what we might be losing in the process. And I would further suggest that each of us has a role to play, not only in making sure that we and our children get the best out of our amazing new information technologies, but also that we find ways to protect and sustain the unique benefits that the printed word provided our ancestors and can still provide to all of us. I began this talk with the Greek writer Aristotle. Let me end it with the English writer Samuel Johnson. On a spring evening in 1775, Johnson accompanied his friend James Boswell on a visit to Richard Owen Cambridge's grand villa on the banks of the Thames outside London. They were shown into the library, where Cambridge was waiting to meet them, and after a brief greeting, Johnson darted to the shelves and began silently reading the spines of the volumes arrayed there. "Dr. Johnson," said Cambridge, "it seems odd that one should have such a desire to look at the backs of books." Johnson, Boswell would later recall, instantly started from his reverie, wheeled about, and replied, "Sir, the reason is very plain. Knowledge is of two kinds. We know a subject ourselves, or we know where we can find information upon it. The net grants us instant access to a library of information unprecedented in its size and its scope, and it makes it easy for us to sort through that library, to find, if not exactly what we were looking for, at least something sufficient for our immediate purposes. What the net diminishes is Johnson's primary kind of knowledge, the ability to know in depth a subject for ourselves, to construct within our own minds the rich set of connections that give rise to a singular intelligence." Thank you for your attention.
I guess my two questions are, one is to look back historically at Gutenberg and what lengths of typical texts were at that time. And then currently, in surfing the internet, with regard to length of works that are surfed on the internet, like I'm thinking at more voluminous works that I look at on the internet when I'm able to download academic journals. Is there a particular point at which somebody will download or print an item on the internet when it gets to a certain length?
Yeah. Okay. I think I got all that. I think the answer to your first question is, I don't know what the median or average length of works printed, early printed works were, but I think it's fair to say they range from one page to a whole lot of pages. I mean, Gutenberg's first two jobs were printing indulgences for the Catholic Church, which I assume were one-page things, and his other one was printing the great Gutenberg Bible, which was a very massive work. And so I think from the start, the printing press was used for printed works of all different lengths. And I think you're right that, we see a progression of incorporating different types of media in with text, and it didn't begin just with Blake, but I think even before the printed book, obviously most books were illuminated, so there were illustrations incorporated into them, and then you're absolutely right that we moved and brought in photography and graphs and stuff like that. But I think there's a fundamental difference between that mode of presentation, even though in a sense it's multimedia, you're dealing with text and images, and the influx of many, many, many different types of media and of messages that we typically juggle when we go online and look at a screen. I mean, a good example to me, and it's a very simple example, is if you do a book search, for instance, on Google Books, which has been a very useful service, I have to admit, in doing research. But what Google will deliver to you is a page of text, if you're lucky, if you're not just a little snippet, but a page of text, but all around that are images and links and various tools aligned up that you can use to cut and paste and do all sorts of things. And on the one hand, every single one of those links and every single one of those tools is very valuable, but it sticks text, even book text, into what the writer and blogger Cory Doctorow once, and this is a good term for it, described as the ecosystem of interruption technologies that our computers are always plunging us into. So on the one hand, multimedia or having two things going on a page at once is nothing new, but the screen, as opposed to the printed page, by bringing in so many different multimedia simultaneously along with constant streams of messages, demands the type of multitasking that gets in the way of the attentiveness required to really not only read, but deeply interpret text.
What I wanted to ask you to comment on is the effect of digital medium on societies, general peoples, people that are using them, that is, on their short-term and long-term memory, if you've come across anything on that.
Yeah, I didn't talk about that, but I spend quite a bit of time talking about that in the book, because short-term memory, or what's sometimes called working memory, is very different and is formed in a very different way than long-term memory. And short-term memory is in essence where we're processing all the things coming at us all the time. It's basically the same as our consciousness. We're conscious of what's in short-term working memory, and we're not conscious of anything else. Long-term memory requires a great deal of attention to be formed, and there's all sorts of kind of physical changes that go on with the formation of long-term memories that don't go on with short-term memories, which are mainly electrochemical. One of the ways in which we build knowledge, particularly complex conceptual knowledge, is through moving information from our working memory, where if we don't concentrate on it and attend to it, it disappears very quickly, into our long-term memory, because it's only when it moves into our long-term memory that it begins to connect with the other information and the other memories, and that's where we get richness of thinking and rich conceptual knowledge. The problem is, with the net, that transition, that transfer of information from short-term working memory to long-term memory requires attentiveness. And it might be the kind of like overwhelming attentiveness you get when a tragedy happens, like 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination, which kind of burns stuff into your long-term memory. But generally, it's attention that lasts some period of time. You have to really think about something and attend to something to get it into your long-term memory. And if your focus keeps shifting, if you're constantly distracted and interrupted, that transfer never happens, and your thinking remains superficial or shallow. So I think that's one of the basic neuroscientific explanations for why we should be worried about the constant kind of state of distractedness that we often find ourselves in today as we multitask and do other things online.
So you touched upon the habit-forming nature of the patterns on the internet, and it's also a fact that, a lot of the industry is interested in capitalizing on that in various forms, in terms of getting your attention, either for commercial or other reasons. So if you put these two things together, and we say that, it's kind of the internet is there to stay, of course, and, people are going to try to expand the amount of, attention-grabbing distractions that they put on you.
Unfortunately, I think I agree with that, that if we look at it at a society-wide basis, at least, there doesn't seem to be any countercurrent or counterculture that pushes us in the opposite direction. And in fact, if you look at the development of the web, for instance, it's always toward more and faster delivery of information. And with the rise of social networking, for instance, recently we've gone from the page being the kind of metaphor of choice for information on the web to the stream, as Facebook and Google and everything, and Twitter, like, say, it's a constant, very rapid bombardment by very short pieces of information. So I'm not optimistic about the trend. On the other hand, we all are individuals, and we all ultimately do have choices in how we pay attention or fail to pay attention. And, if by writing this and talking about this, I can raise people's awareness and even a few people start to challenge themselves in how they're spending their time, then I would be grateful for that, but it's not easy. It's easy to say, cut back, but if you're, as you said, if your job expectations, if your social expectations, if your school expectations are that you're always connected and you're always processing information, there's a big sacrifice involved to cut back.
I'm really interested in whether there's been research on the different kinds of delivery of the media on the web. There's the words, there's photographs, and there's drawings. And it seems to me, and then there's animated drawings. And I think they could have very different effects on the mind. I've noticed I'm a Huffington Post addict, and it's awful. It's just awful. And I can't keep track of the article. I'm always looking at the things flickering.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, a drawing will show up. It's either on the Huffington Post or Salon. There's just a drawing of a man's face. And I'm just always stopped I just respond completely differently. And I think I slow down. And I just wondered, as you've done your research, is there any serious research on the difference between saturation and bombardment with photographs versus drawings? And hardly anybody's online just to read text. I mean, we're not just looking at text.
Right. I'm sure there are studies of that, and I'm not familiar with them. I know that, I talked a lot about multitasking in multimedia, And there are ways to present information in more than one form simultaneously that can actually enhance learning and enhance understanding. For instance, there's a belief that short-term memory operates different channels when we're taking information in by our ear versus our eye. So, you know, if you're listening to something and you see an illustration, that can actually enhance learning. So it's not that all multimedia presentations are bad. They have very different effects. But in order to have them have good effects and enhance comprehension and enhance learning, they have to be very carefully planned with a view to enhancing learning. And that, of course, never or rarely takes place online where, you know, there's not some educational expert back there figuring out what to put where on a page. There's some marketer and some software designer who actually in many cases are rewarded for keeping you distracted and keeping you moving as quickly as possible.
I'm put in mind this evening of poet Denise Levertov's statement that imagination is our most humanizing characteristic, and she made a pretty quick link to the attribute of compassion along with that. And it seems to me that the gentleman here who is referring to wanting to see what the castle looks like when you're reading a text about, that one of the things that reading offers me is I have to imagine, I mean, an author does one way or another does description, and some people do it marvelously well, but still my imagination is engaged when I'm reading. And I also have a concern around the fact that one of the things that's almost completely absent in my experience sitting at a computer and being online is large muscle, the engagement of any large muscle. So along with, and it changes, it's not just, it's not about exercise. It's not about exercise. It's about how it relaxes the brain and how it soothes the whole body. And I believe that that has an effect on how creatively I can think. I'm really concerned about the whole gift of creativity, and not that people aren't creative in the work that they do online, but in terms of what you're saying about how using this tool may change the way we are as human beings.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there are different kinds of creativity. And so the act of getting lots of information, talking to lots of people, jumping around, that can obviously spur creativity of one kind. But then there's the other kind that you talk about that really requires deep engagement. And I think I'm always wary of saying this because, you know, I know that I'll read on Twitter that, you know, Nick Carr says we're being made immoral by the Internet or something. But there is evidence that kind of our deeper, most human emotions, the kind of higher forms of empathy and stuff like that, actually emerge from fairly slow cognitive processes. They take time to emerge in the brain, whereas more primitive emotions, like empathy with physical suffering, they happen immediately. So there is, you know, some evidence, and I think it's much too early to connect it to web use, but there is certainly evidence that not only is the depth of our thinking and imagination, but also the depth of our emotions are somehow connected to our ability to pay attention.
It seems to me that attention span's been under assault for a while now. Growing up, pre-internet, they always talked about television ruining children's attention span, and it's not perhaps just the internet, but...
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we tend to think of the internet as new media in this fundamental break with old media, but in fact, in many ways it is, but in other ways, there's continuity there. And I would agree that mass media, modern mass media, particularly electric and electronic mass media, have imposed distractions and shortened our attention span for a long time, not only because of the nature of the technology, but because of the nature of the programming that comes through it. And so I see the net as an amplification of a long-term trend rather than a sudden change.